Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. To address the WikiLeaks revelations, we are joined today for the full hour by Mara Verheiden-Hilliard. She is the executive director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund in Washington, D.C. We're also joined in studio by Eugene Puryear, the host of Radio Sputnik's By Any Means Necessary, and by Michael Preisner. He's an Iraq war veteran turned anti-war organizer and currently the producer for The Empire Files on Telesur. Welcome, Eugene, Michael, and Mara.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining. Eugene Puryear, let's start with you. There was an article in the Washington Post. It was entitled Inside Bill Clinton Inc. Hacked Memo Reveals Intersection of Charity and Personal Income. I want to read a quick paragraph to you from the article. It says, the memo made public Wednesday, that was last Wednesday, by the anti-secrecy group WikiLeaks, lays out the aggressive strategy behind lining up consulting contracts and paid speaking engagements for Bill Clinton that added tens of millions of dollars to the family's fortune, including during the years that Hillary Clinton led the State Department. It described how Band, that's Doug Band, helped run what he called Bill Clinton Inc., obtaining, quote, in-kind services for the president and his family for personal travel, hospitality, vacation, and the like, close quote. Now, Hillary Clinton's campaign spokesman told the Washington Post, his name is Glenn Kaplan, we declined to comment on the memo. And then he called the material hacked by the Russian government and weaponized by WikiLeaks. Kaplan declined to authenticate the memo, but he also did not dispute it. That's from the Washington Post. Go ahead, Eugene Puryear. Quite interesting, and also perhaps would have been a giant story, but somehow was a second tier story in this election campaign.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And the, you know, the Clinton campaign has not disputed any of these. They're just trying to get people to look in the other direction. But I think what's super important about this is, you know, the 13-page memo just was another confirmation of a lot of what we already knew, that clearly people were making big donations and they were hoping for some sort of specialized treatment. Now, the Clinton campaign has said from the beginning, well, you know, there's no quid pro quo. There's no smoking gun. The Clinton Foundation does great work. So who even knows? And so it's very important to look at the timing of what was taking place here with Mr. Band and Chelsea Clinton, who were engaged in what really was quite frankly a battle for control of the Clinton Foundation. Doug Band, longtime aide to Bill Clinton. Chelsea Clinton comes in, and if you look at the timing of this, it's mostly happening in 2011, in the fall of 2011, early 2012. There is a move led by Chelsea Clinton in conjunction, it appears, with Cheryl Mills and to some degree perhaps John Podesta, although it's unclear exactly if he was playing both sides, what role he was playing, to quote-unquote professionalize the Clinton Foundation, which included pushing out Doug Band. The reasons that Chelsea Clinton gives for this are actually quite interesting because she raises how the whole thing was run in an entirely unprofessional manner, how individuals, she doesn't quite name them, but it seems Doug Band and other high-level officials were not only arranging for this in-kind type of quid pro quo situation that Doug Band had outlined to President Clinton, but also trying to enrich themselves personally. She even accuses them essentially of stealing money behind the scenes of the Clintons. And she relays a story in one of the emails about contacts of hers in London who were suggesting that the Clinton Foundation, similar to Tony Blair's foundation, which, by the way, is well known for offering quid pro quo for large amounts of money to give political cover to certain leaders, that what was happening in this case is that people from the Teneo group run by Doug Band were contacting people inside of the parliament in the UK seeking for particular favors using the name of Bill Clinton. And so when you put all this together, what you find out is when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, the Clinton Foundation was operating in a way, and this is confirmed by Chelsea Clinton here now, the daughter, who is very upset about this, the Clinton Foundation was operating in a way where clearly it was directly susceptible to outside interest donating to the Clinton Foundation as a way, or perhaps signing on with Teneo Group as a way to try to influence former President Clinton and almost certainly Hillary Clinton and her team, including her daughter, wanted to push out Doug Band because they recognize that there is a very serious issue here that if Hillary Clinton ever wanted to run for president again and if their names were not going to be besmirched, both the former president and Secretary Clinton, that they had to end the current practices of the Clinton Foundation. But the final thing I'll say is this, is once they to make the transition to a more normal operation of how a foundation operates, not like a slush fund, which is what Chelsea is implying, that she still is suggesting to individuals working on the transition away from Band that they then bring on the global chairman of PricewaterhouseCoopers, one of the largest firms in international finance and business around the world now, who she calls a personal friend and mentor. So even when it becomes professionalized, you still see it's operating in a way where the social membrane that exists amongst these people in the 1%, that it still ultimately is an operation that is being run in the interest of and in the desires of the richest people around the world, and the way they view the world, the way they view government, and the way they view philanthropy to operate, which I think, as we've seen in Haiti, for instance, is quite terrible.
Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, in order for us to have learned these facts, which are really shocking in some ways, at least maybe not for people who are cynical enough, having paid close attention to the workings of the 1% and how they manipulate the government for their own ends, but perhaps shocking for the public, in order for the people to know these facts, a couple of things had to happen. There had to be a dispute from within the Clinton Foundation, whereby Doug Band, who had done all of this money and created what he called Bill Clinton Inc., in other words, a way for influence peddling and the enrichment of the former president of the United States, he was being pushed out by other members of the Clinton Foundation, and in particular, Chelsea Clinton. So in his own defense, he writes this 12-page memo with all these revelations. And then, we, of course, the second piece to it is that we would have never known that unless WikiLeaks revealed this information by the hack or the revelation of the Podesta emails. Now, the way this story and that story could have been the October surprise, perhaps WikiLeaks has its own agenda, its own hostility towards Hillary Clinton. It would have been certainly a major story. But from the beginning, since these email hacks came out, the Clinton administration and I think the mainstream media have said over and over, hey, you know what? It doesn't matter what's in the emails. Content doesn't matter. It's why these emails were published and who published them. They were the work of foreign intelligence. They were the work of Russia. They were an attempt to influence the election. Talk about how this effort by the Clinton campaign to sort of distract attention has been, I would say, largely so successful.
Well, the fact of what's now being revealed about the Clinton Foundation and through this Band memo, it's a huge enterprise. It's a massive enterprise. It's a massively corrupt enterprise. And the fact is, it's so big, many people knew about it. I mean, it wasn't something that was operating, you know, on the sidelines in secret. It actually was operating in a large, visible way, but to those who are engaged in it, to those who are operating within that corrupt sphere. So all of these other national governments that were donating money, the Saudis and everyone else, all of these large corporations that were benefiting so much from this, Coca-Cola and USB and others, they all obviously know about it, UBS, I mean, but the public didn't know about it. And so it was this operation in the higher percentages of the 1%, where all of them know, but the rest of us don't know. And now, when WikiLeaks began indicating that it had emails or that it had information about the inner workings of the Clinton Foundation, and people were waiting for this to come, they knew it was going to come that first full week of October. The timing is so interesting because on October 7th, on that Friday, we have the administration, the Obama administration, coming out to have a very major statement announcing that they are officially accusing the Russian government of engaging in basically cyber espionage in order to impact the elections. It becomes the big headline. It becomes the dominant theme in the news that day, saying that the intelligence agencies have come to this conclusion. When you read through how they come to the conclusion over and over again, it's just based on sort of looking at a tactical analysis. They're not pointing to anything mechanically specific that they can tie back. So while that comes out, it becomes the headline. Within hours after that, the Washington Post is suddenly given, or around the same time, they're suddenly given this Trump tape showing Donald Trump's just disgusting misogynist views and expressions about women and bragging about sexually assaulting women. That then also becomes a major dominant headline, and both of these then fall on top of the moment that WikiLeaks begins to release. And certainly many people question what the government knew, what the intelligence agencies knew, what others knew about the timing of the WikiLeaks release and these efforts to get these stories out on top of the WikiLeaks release. And with the WikiLeaks release, which really is extraordinary material, I mean, absolutely extraordinary material about someone that is running to become president of the United States, who is highly likely to become president of the United States. And those stories are being completely underplayed or not even presented in the mainstream media. And when they're forced to present them, for example, the story about the most recent release of the banned memo, which is astonishing memo. For example, even the New York Times, their headline is "Donations to Foundation Vexed Hillary Clinton's AIDS Email Show." I mean, that is not what the story is. It's not that it was vexing her AIDS. It's that it was a completely corrupt commercial enterprise that was raising money that went also to the personal benefit to the Clintons, you know, in the millions of dollars.
Mike Preisner, you are an Iraq war veteran. You are also the producer with the Empire Files on Telesur. You have done a lot of work, a lot of research about the WikiLeaks email revelations. You've done a lot of work about the Clinton campaign, about the connection between the Saudi government and other foreign governments to the Clinton Foundation. But I want to ask you about those things. But first, I want to ask you about the comment on Glenn Kaplan, Hillary Clinton's campaign spokesperson's comment about why they won't comment to the Washington Post when it ran the story Bill Clinton Inc. And again, Kaplan says it's hacked by the Russian government and weaponized by WikiLeaks. I mean, what does it mean to be weaponized? What does it mean to have information weaponized? That's a new word.
Yeah, you know, it's been actually quite comical watching the news coverage, because no matter who it is from the Clinton campaign or anyone linked to these emails, you know, it's obviously their default answer whenever they're asked to just default to the Russian government. You know, it's not a far-fetched thing that someone else could have hacked these emails. I mean, I think the last major hacker that was arrested, which was this month, was a 16-year-old kid. So these aren't, you know, high-tech, really, you know, advanced operations that other hackers can't take part in. There's also like a long string of things that was revealed in the emails about how these things could have gotten out. Also, for example, John Podesta's email password, extremely weak. We know from the emails that he clicked on malware, these very kind of basic phishing schemes that get your passwords. We know that he left his cell phone in a cab in D.C. We know that they mailed a laptop with all of their email archives on it that got lost in the mail. So there's all these other more feasible ways that these emails could have gotten out. But I think the interesting thing is that they keep defaulting to this, you know, it's the evil Russian government that's responsible for this to influence the election. But what's also revealed from, you know, John Podesta is that John Podesta is actually the one with ties to the Russian government. His lobbying efforts, you know, he was receiving quite a lot of money from Russia's biggest bank. He was receiving quite a lot of money from the European Center for Modern Ukraine, which is a you know, Russian-linked organization. So actually, you know, lobbying on behalf of the government, he said, hacked their emails. And in particular, you know, this company, Uranium One, is a company that was acquired by a Russian investment firm. And this was, he was lobbying on behalf of this. And in fact, that Russian investment bank, when they announced their intention to buy Uranium One, gave Bill Clinton $500,000 for a speech in Moscow. So, you know, I think they're worried about their own connections coming out here. But, you know, it all goes back to how this is just kind of this very seedy, you know, pay to play organization that the Clintons are involved in, but also they're a very good match in John Podesta.
Well, and I think that's a good point, and I want to pick up there. I mean, because, you know, a couple points. One, I mean, when the most recent sanctions went in on Russia, people have forgotten about this. The Business Roundtable and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce took out full-page ads in the three major national newspapers in the United States opposed to this. They had to have their arms twisted by the U.S. government for this. So there is so much money floating around from Russia, Russian-related companies, American companies doing business in Russia, especially oil companies, that this whole thing about quote-unquote ties to Russia is completely ridiculous, completely overblown, and clearly an unbelievable political, cynical political move, but it's working. So I guess it shows that to some degree it was a smart move and perhaps why the Clintons are where they are despite this. But I also wanted to pick up on a little bit of how this works, because I think that, you know, a lot of times it's not just about the whole issue with the, you know, direct quid pro quo, but the way it works out. I mean, you look at Goldman Sachs and the New York Times, which laid out in a deep article, a long article about how close Goldman Sachs is with the Clinton Foundation. And then what you see is when Hillary Clinton is leaving the State Department and looking to move, the Clinton Foundation is asking her, Huma Abedin, about the potential office space. And she says, well, we're at 77 Water Street now, which was a tower controlled by Goldman Sachs that no one would move into. And Bill Clinton moves some of his offices there as a show of support for Goldman Sachs in the wake of the economic crisis. So when they're the most demonized, and the woman who is working for the Clinton Foundation says, well, you guys have to decide soon, although, because they have someone who's coming in here, but because of our relationship with Goldman, they're willing to hold the lease on one of these pieces of property that they really needed to make money back on. So you see how close they are and the way that all these little different favors and things like that start to add up.
Okay, that was the voice of Eugene Puryear. We're going to come back. We've been talking about the WikiLeaks revelations, a top-tier story that's been made into either a second tier or maybe even a non-story as a consequence of how the U.S. media has treated it. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We're talking about the WikiLeaks revelations. We are joined today for the full hour by Mara Verheyden-Hilliard. She is the executive director of the Washington, D.C.-based Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. We're also joined in studio by Eugene Puryear, the host of Radio Sputnik's By Any Means Necessary, and by Michael Preisner, Iraq war veteran turned anti-war organizer, and he is a producer for the Empire Files on Telesur. Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, there was a 12-page memo. That's how we know about this pay-for-play influence peddling in its specificity from Doug Band, who was being pushed out of the foundation by Chelsea Clinton and by others. There's been a lot about it. He wrote, and Band writes to in this part of this 12-page memorandum, independent of our fundraising and decision-making activities on behalf of the foundation, we have dedicated ourselves to helping the president secure and engage in for-profit activities, including speeches, books, and advisory service engagements. In that context, we have, in effect, served as agents, lawyers, managers, and implementers to secure speaking and business and advisory service deals in support of the president's for-profit activity. We have also solicited and obtained, as appropriate, in-kind services for the president and his family, for personal travel, hospitality, vacation, and the like. Neither Justin nor I are separately compensated for these activities. We do not receive a fee for or percentage of the more than $50 million for-profit activity we have personally helped to secure for President Clinton to date, or the $66 million in future contracts should he choose to continue with those engagements. Anywhere else in the world, that would be utter, complete corruption. Go ahead, Mara.
His memo describing those efforts that you just recounted goes directly in conflict with the statements that Hillary Clinton took, well, more specifically, her requirements under the law when she was waiting to be appointed and confirmed as Secretary of State. In January of 2009, then pre-Secretary Hillary Clinton had to sign a letter agreeing under the government's ethics laws, which are 18 U.S. Code 208, which require that anyone that's going to hold an executive appointed position, such as Secretary of State, has no financial conflicts and that they will not engage in certain activities that have a financial conflict. She said, neither my husband nor I have any financial interest in or fiduciary role with the William Jefferson Clinton Foundation or the Clinton Global Initiative. This memo speaks completely to the opposite. And you have this interrelationship where SNAO is making money with its clients based on its access to the Clinton Foundation and to the Clintons. The Clintons are making money directly from the same people that then Teneo's bringing in to make donations to the foundation. Teneo's big clients, Coke, Dow, UBS, all of them handing cash over and cash that the Clintons are personally benefiting from. This goes directly against and in conflict with the law, as she was obligated to abide by that law, by the ethics laws as secretary. And frankly, you know, as president and running for president with these conflicts that are now, you know, plain, they're visible. I mean, many people were generally aware of them and talking about them, but there was no level of this specificity in the magnitude of what's actually happening. I mean, she is nothing but a walking conflict of interest. And frankly, if anyone were to try and unravel her conflicts of interest to clear her for the role that she wants to hold as the president of the United States, I mean, it would take the length of a term to do so, and it would seem impossible to do so. So now she's likely to be elected president of the United States. She has these massive conflicts of interest. Her husband has these massive conflicts of interest. And it creates a situation where I don't think that anyone will be able to look at any action she takes with regard to anything involving all the matters that come before a president, dealing with other world powers, dealing with interests that benefit corporations, all of them, the Clinton Foundation, Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, they have an interest. They've had a finger in all of those activities.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point Mara's making. This is Eugene Perrier. I just want to jump in again because, you know, we also have in these Podesta emails some stuff from the Obama era, the earlier era when he's coming in, that shows exactly how this works. And I want to outline some of it. So in 2008, John Podesta gets an email. It's a chain of emails from someone named Mary Pat Bonner. Now, who is that? She is something that people call a donor whisperer. She is someone who helps political campaigns, and certainly someone who's a neophyte like Obama needs this, reach very wealthy individuals. So one of the people she is able to get money from for Democrats, the guy named Fred Barron, he's now passed of cancer, and he is a big-time trial lawyer in Texas. So he is dying of cancer, and his wife is very notably very upset, and she finds that there is this experimental drug that potentially can save his life. Now, of course, like any family member would do, she starts contacting everyone who can make a difference. But here it is. She's a big-time donor. So Mary Pat Bonner reaches out to John Podesta as part of this broader thing and says, can you help pressure these people because the FDA has to create a special carve out for this one individual? So this guy, Fred Barron, this is what happens. This is unbelievable. So the people who intervene on his behalf are William J. Clinton, Lance Armstrong, John Podesta, Senator John Kerry, and it looks like, I can't tell 100% from the email, but it looks like maybe even also Senator Tom Harkin. And they all intervene, and also who else intervenes? The head of the FDA. So here you have a direct line here. Someone who bundles large donations, relaying an actual request from a high-dollar donor to a number of high-level government officials, including the head of the FDA, that gets on a conference call with the head of the company and says, let this guy use this experimental drug, even though the company says, I don't even think this is legal. I don't even think you have the ability to do this. This is the direct perversion of the public process in exchange for money for a personal favor. That's exactly what took place there with all of those individuals out there. And that's what this shows.
I mean, there are so many stories within this major story. And again, it's been made a second tier story, a non-story, because the media functions as an echo chamber for the Clinton campaign. And the Clinton campaign says, hey, you know, we just don't have to talk about any of these things because these are just the instrumentality of a foreign power, an enemy power, Russia, the power that the Pentagon in its quadrennial report under the Obama administration identified as the main threat to the United States globally. Mike Prizner, let's go back to the Doug Band 12-page memo where he's defending himself and saying, well, you know, if you say, as Chelsea Clinton was inferring, that he was corrupt, he was saying, well, everything I'm doing with Bill Clinton and for Bill Clinton. And he says in this memorandum, and again, this is reprinted in the Atlantic magazine from Friday, with respect to business deals for his advisory services, Justin and I found, developed, and brought to President Clinton multiple arrangements for him to accept or reject. Of his current four arrangements, we secured all of them. And we have helped manage and maintained all of his for-profit business relationships. Since 2001, President Clinton's business arrangements have yielded more than $30 million for him personally, with $66 million to be paid out for the next 9 years should he continue with those engagements, as I had read before. Go ahead, Michael Preisner. You've done a lot of research on this. This is, I don't know, is it criminal?
I would say so. I mean, look, I mean, this career for Bill Clinton, as you said, you know, which has gotten him in the tens of millions of dollars, and a very similar type of career for Hillary Clinton, also doing very high paid speeches to people who want access to seats of power in the U.S. government. This is something that really started when Bill Clinton left office, and his, you know, his new power as a former president really was the driver of him having access to government and, you know, the ability to do these high paid speeches for people who want access to the government. Of course, Hillary during this time doing the very same things. There's so many countless examples of, you know, quid pro quo type things, a paid speech by someone who has a lot to gain. And then, of course, that company or foreign government gaining from their investment after they fork out, you know, a million or so to the Clintons. I think it's important to point out that this is the period after Bill Clinton's presidency. While Hillary's positions of power was as a senator, as Secretary of State, but a lot of these things took place when she was not in these positions. What is to come? I mean, it's seeming likely that Hillary Clinton is going to be in the White House, that her husband, Bill Clinton, is also going to be in the White House. And they're going into the White House now with this apparatus having been built for more than a decade and connections having been built for more than a decade and them carrying out these practices for more than a decade. So, you know, we can only imagine what's going to happen when there's both of those Clintons are back in the White House with this entire scheme around them. You know, I think one of the interesting things from these emails is that there are dozens of emails of Hillary's staff referring to themselves as Hillary Land, basically pointing out that they are this elite network of very powerful people who wield a lot of influence. It's really, you know, all the things that people have grown to hate about DC politics is embodied by this Bill Clinton Inc. and Hillary Land scheme.
Mara Verheiden Hilliard, if Hillary Clinton is elected and these facts are now available, that means that these will be the subject of many, many congressional inquiries. They may be the subject of criminal inquiries as well. I mean, this will undoubtedly become a part of whatever the next Clinton administration period, you know, takes place. I mean, it's going to be at least for the first months, perhaps for years. But I want to ask you also, so comment on that if you would, but I also want to ask you about the fact that she did not use the State Department server. In other words, the other emails that have come out before the Podesta email hack. Those seem to be ancient history right now. But one of the questions always has been, why would Hillary Clinton have used a private email server? Obviously, it was very susceptible to being hacked. She even admitted, and we know it from some of the revelations, that they were aware that they were always being targeted, perhaps by foreign governments, by China or by Russia, she mentions in one of the emails. And yet she takes her email server off the government premises, its personal email. I mean, so talk about that. But you have filed many Freedom of Information Act requests, public records requests with the State Department, including when Hillary Clinton was the Secretary of State. If the State Department were searching their records for emails relevant to a public records request that you might have or other entities may have made on the State Department, they wouldn't have found those emails because they were all on her private server, not on the State Department server. I mean, that must have been well known by everybody in the State Department that she wasn't using the State Department server. Talk about why she did it and how widely known it would have been.
The State Department would have had to have known that she was operating off of a private server simply because there were many FOIA requests against the State Department by my organization, by many other organizations. The scope of those requests would have included emails that would have involved the Secretary's office. Now, they obviously wouldn't have been finding those emails, and they would not have been, when searching, they would not have had an area within which to search. It would have been immediately apparent that her emails were located somewhere else, that her aides' emails were somewhere else, and where those aides' emails were within a state server, they would have been indicating this private email address. But I think the point of putting all of this on a private server just actually relates back again to what we're seeing with WikiLeaks. The number one thing that that Hillary Clinton was concerned about in terms of exposure, and I think this is true for many government officials, but you can see it plainly here, it was less a fear that a foreign government would get a hold of private or confidential material, and that any concerns there were for that were completely outweighed by the dominant fear, which is that the people of the United States might be able to learn what their government was doing. That's the purpose of the Freedom of Information Act. It's an order for the public, the people of the United States, to be able to see the inner workings, to see what's happening with the government, to see what the government says that it's doing, is doing in their names, so that the people can hold their government officials to account. That is an essential element of democracy. You have to know what they're doing in order to be able to hold them accountable for it. And it's that accountability of the people of the United States that Hillary Clinton was trying to avoid. And you can see that now with the exposure through the WikiLeaks releases, both of the other emails as well as now the Podesta emails. This constant effort to sort of run almost like a shadow operation that has huge impacts on the foreign policy and commercial enterprises that the U.S. government supports around the world. You know, and the hypocrisy, I mean, when the Panama Papers came out, the U.S. government didn't say, oh, we can't talk about them or look at them because we think those were illegally hacked. They were like, yeah, let's see if we can tie this back to Putin, and hopefully the Panama Papers will indicate corruption on the part of Russia. I mean, there wasn't suddenly some firewall that said we can't talk about the Panama Papers because they're ill-gotten. When it comes to these, suddenly, no, you know, we're not going to talk about them. They are, as you said, they're being defined as weaponized. But actually, WikiLeaks is doing a public service. They are putting out there the information that should be publicly available to the people of the United States so that they can make decisions. So now that the information is out there, the next layer comes in, which is the mainstream media, which is unwilling to talk about them, which talks about them only to the extent that they have to maintain some level of credibility. And there is an effort to endlessly suppress this information. I mean, the fact is that if Hillary Clinton were running against almost any other candidate, it would be impossible for her to be elected. But she's running against Donald Trump, who is such a completely repugnant, racist, misogynist that people just are completely offended by him and are not mobilizing behind him. And in fact, he's so awful that the establishment can't support him. The same backers that would support George Bush previously are now in the camp of Hillary Clinton because they cannot tolerate someone like Donald Trump being the face of the United States and him being the head of state of the United States, because it would be bad for the United States and bad for business. And that's the reason that she can succeed at this point. But these emails pose a real challenge. So as you said, as soon as she takes office, in the right wing is going to be seizing on this, attempting to have investigations into her conduct, criminal investigations. I'm sure anyone in Congress with subpoena power that, you know, wants to try and just start an immediate drumbeat, I'm sure they'll be calling for impeachment within hours of her taking office. And it's an unfortunate position because it too is going to be telling the Clinton camp will be telling progressive people in the United States that they have to line up behind Hillary Clinton in order to fight the right wing and fascism in America, when there actually has to be another way, another presentation of the people of conscience in the United States who absolutely are repulsed by Donald Trump, but similarly do not want to support a warmongering Clinton.
That's Mara Verheyden-Hilliard. She is the executive director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. We're talking about the WikiLeaks revelations. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. And clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We're talking about the WikiLeaks revelations, and we are joined today for the full hour by Mara Verheyden-Hilliard. She is the executive director of the Washington, D.C.-based Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. We're also joined in studio by Eugene Priere, the host of Radio Sputnik's By Any Means Necessary, and by Michael Preisner, Iraq war veteran turned anti-war organizer and currently producer for the Empire Files on Telesur. Michael Preisner, I want to talk to you about the impact of donations and funding by foreign governments to the Clinton Foundation and the personal enrichment of the Clintons at the expense of foreign forces, including foreign governments, and what its impact would be on the Clinton campaign and its impact on a Clinton administration. Now, we have heard from the Clinton campaign and from the mainstream media that Russia is meddling in the American elections, that Putin views Donald Trump as his candidate. I don't know why. I don't know why anyone would think that the Russian government would be happy that someone like Donald Trump would, you know, have control over the nuclear codes in the United States. I don't really get that one. Of course, Trump said a few things about maybe we should have better relations with Russia, but I don't know if that would mean that Russia would be happy about Donald Trump. But that aside, the narrative is Russia is influencing American elections. John Kerry, in his speech before the Chicago Council on Foreign Affairs, his wrap-up speech on foreign policy, he said it the other last Thursday. He said that Putin is trying to influence the American elections. I mean, again, no evidence. But you do have Saudi Arabia, who, according to the Podesta email hacks, you have Hillary Clinton saying to John Podesta, we have to influence our friends or something like that, our allies or Saudi Arabia. In other words, a country that we can influence, because they have direct ties, they're financing, supporting ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and other terrorist organizations. And yet, Podesta and the Podesta family, they're very tightly tied to Saudi Arabia.
Right. I mean, the Podesta family and the Clinton family, I think the Saudi government is one of the top, if not the top donor to the Clinton Foundation. Of course, you know, they have a very vested interest in having Hillary Clinton become the president. I mean, when she was Secretary of State, you know, one of the most brazen examples of the pay-to-play scheme is that all of the Gulf monarchs that were donating to the Clinton Foundation, Saudi Arabia being the biggest of those, were given arms deals by Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. And the amount that they got in their arms deal directly corresponded to the amount of money that they donated. And so, of course, Saudi Arabia donating the most amount of money got the most amount of weapons. They are now putting those weapons to a lot of use in Yemen, massacring people left and right, and something that shows, you know, no real signs of stopping now. And so, of course, they want that flow to keep going with the next president. Aside from the Clinton Foundation, which receives millions of dollars from the Saudi government, the Podesta Group, the lobbying firm that was founded by John Podesta, gets about $150,000 a month from the Saudi government to lobby on behalf of the Saudi government in seats of power in D.C., being an advocate for the interests of the Saudi government. So I think that that's quite blatant there. I mean, even Hillary Clinton herself acknowledges in these leaked emails that the Saudi government is also one of the funders of ISIS. And so to, on the one hand, say acknowledge that this is money is going to ISIS, and then also a lot of that money is going into my bank account, I think that shows that there's a lot to go on with President Hillary in terms of controversy and conflict. One of the other, you know, ways that this plays out, you know, it's not a secret. You know, it's so well known that both the Podestas and the Clintons have this, you know, really tight relationship with the Saudi government, to the point where the lawyer for the 9/11 families that are working to sue the Saudi government for their support of the 9/11 hijackers, in one of the leaked emails, the lead attorney for the 9/11 families emails John Podesta to say, hey, I just want you to know that me going after the Saudi government doesn't mean that I'm trying to attack you guys. And this is just because I care about the families, and warns him. He says, we are about to launch this public thing that's going to really call into question the interests of the Saudi government and shady things that we do. And we know that this could possibly hurt the Clinton campaign because you are so close with them. So gave him a heads up saying, I want you to know that this isn't, you know, this isn't malicious and from my side to impact you guys, but I want you to know that it's going to happen so you can prepare yourselves to respond to the things that I'm going to have to put out about your biggest donor.
Eugene, one of the emails is a Clinton Foundation aide writing, Gothar would like to see WJC, that's Bill Clinton, for 5 minutes in New York City to present a $1 million check that Gothar promised for William Clinton's birthday in 2011. Now, the document goes on, Qatar would welcome our suggestion for investments in Haiti, particularly on education and health. They have allocated most of their $20 million, but are happy to consider projects we suggest. I'm collecting input from the CF Haiti team. Now, Qatar is another one of the Gulf monarchies. You have Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Kuwait, Qatar. These are the allies of the United States in the Gulf, really decrepit, bankrupt, blood monarchies that people have no rights. Women, of course, in Saudi Arabia, no rights at all. Routinely, the Saudi government does just what ISIS does. It decapitates people even for small crimes. You have 15 of the 19 hijackers who carried out the September 11th attack, according to the government's own report, were Saudis. The Saudis are supporting and financing ISIS and Al-Qaeda. We know that. They were principal supporters of the Taliban when it formed as a government in the 1990s and before that as a movement. Go ahead. Talk about that.
Well, you know, in Buckley v. Vallejo, which is the first case that regulated campaign finance, you know, the one of the things was is that, you know, the interest of the government in regulating finances wasn't that there was direct corruption, but even just the appearance of corruption. And it's only now in this era of Citizens United that this new bar has been raised. And now Hillary Clinton says she's against Citizens United, whereby, you know, you have to have some direct smoking gun quid pro quo, like I gave you $5 and you gave me, you know, X. And so by the own standards, and so many Democrats, including Hillary Clinton, are against that. So according to their own standards now about the way corruption, quote unquote, should even be viewed, that you don't need a direct quid pro quo. Again, this is what all Democrats argue now, that under that criteria, there is really no other way that you could possibly look at this than that these people were giving this money hoping for influence. And the reality is that, and I think what's revealed in these emails, is you never know exactly when and where it's going to come from. Sometimes you want something direct. Sometimes you just want to have a couple favors in the bank that you can call on later in the situation. And I think that that's something, and that's why I let the piece out about the FDA thing. I mean, that's a kind of a completely random thing that a big time donor gets cancer and, you know, some of their family is freaking out trying to save their life. And all of a sudden they can call on all these big favors like, hey, I gave you all this money. Like, now I need you to pervert the public process for something that I need to happen. In this case, you know, to try to save a gentleman's life who was dying of cancer. And so you never really know exactly what's going to happen and exactly where it's going to come. But I think there's really no other way to look at this than to look at the fact that the entire presentation here is designed to create the perception that the Clintons will take money and that in response to that money, they will potentially do a favor for you, which we've seen in email after email after email that was continuously dismissed about someone saying, well, can so-and-so get a meeting with Clinton? Can so-and-so's resume go to the top of the pile? I mean, this is how it is. It's influence peddling at its finest. And I just wanted to add, you know, one particular thing here about the whole the criminal aspect of this is that one thing that's consistently revealed in these emails is how the so-called walls that exist between these big super PACs and the campaigns are very, very small. They're permeable. They do not exist. Tom Steyer, who is a very rich, multi-million dollar guy, spends millions and millions of dollars, one of the top donors in the liberal side of things, primarily around climate justice causes. There's a whole exchange there with Podesta, I think someone else, Mark Elias, who is their lawyer, on Tom Steyer. And they're saying that, okay, we tried to get this money for Steyer. We tried to get him to do a fundraiser for Hillary Clinton. He didn't want to do it because he wants to spend money on independent expenditures, doesn't want to potentially skirt the law. So then they go into this whole thing, and I won't go into the whole thing, but basically the whole thing is about, well, can we find a way to get around the law? Like, could he have a fundraiser for us and then do the independent expenditures? The lawyer, Mark Elias or Elias or however it's pronounced, then says, that actually won't work, but let's take this conversation offline and talk in person. So he recognized they were going into a gray area of illegal coordination, but then I double checked. And what you see is exactly what he said wouldn't work is what ended up happening, that Tom Steyer did a fundraiser for Hillary Clinton, then went on through Next Gen Climate Action to go through and do a number of independent expenditure work, some of which was softly critical of Hillary Clinton. And then he gets ripped in an email dropping several F-bombs from John Podesta to him. So you can see, in fact, I don't know if it's criminal, but certainly it does look like there was some illegal coordination there. And above and beyond anything else, what it shows is that the whole campaign finance thing is a complete fig leaf. And these people have top dollar, you know, $100 an hour lawyers that figure out a way to get around every single campaign finance restriction to be able to have the campaigns and the super PACs that are shadow campaigns able to coordinate at a high level. And I think that's an important thing that needs to be pointed out as well.
Mara Verheyen-Hilliard, I want to ask you about something that the Huffington Post reported. The Saudis hired the Podesta Group in 2015. Now, John Podesta is the chairperson of the Clinton campaign. His brother, Tony Podesta, is still with the Podesta Group. John Podesta himself has separated from the Podesta Group, but they're brothers. They've worked together for a long time. And Tony Podesta is a bundler, is a financier of the Clinton campaign. Tony Podesta is, again, registered foreign agent for the Saudi government. Now, they get $140,000, or Mike Prisoner said $150,000 per month from the Saudis for work done here in Washington. Now, the Saudis hired the Podesta Group, this is from Huffington Post, in 2015, because it was getting hammered in the press over civilian casualties from its airstrikes in Yemen and its crackdown on political dissidents at home, including sentencing blogger Raif Badawi to 10 years in prison and 1,000 lashes for insulting Islam. Since then, Tony Podesta's fingerprints have been all over Saudi Arabia's advocacy efforts in Washington, D.C. When Saudi Arabia executed the prominent nonviolent Shia dissident cleric Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr, causing protests throughout the Shia world and inflaming sectarian divisions. The New York Times noted that the Podesta Group provided the newspaper with a Saudi commentary who defended the execution. Mara, go ahead.
I think it's helpful to remember what happened with the cases of the Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project, the Holy Land Foundation cases, where groups were being prosecuted for providing material support to foreign terrorist organizations. And in those cases, it was the question of whether or not someone could even just speak to or work with, verbal activities that were considered material support or activities that were material support that was funding schools or hospitals. And yet here you have the Saudi government in Clinton's own emails. She acknowledges that the Saudi government and Qatar were providing, quote, clandestine financial and logistical support to ISIL, which I think most people would define as providing material support to a foreign terrorist organization. And that does not stop the Podesta Inc. from taking $140,000 a month and publicly working to support the Saudi government's face inside the United States and lobbying for their interests inside the United States. It doesn't support the Clinton Foundation from taking between $10 million and $25 million from the Saudi government. Now, I think we all know that if any other group were doing anything that, including peaceful actions, not cash-making actions, but just peaceful activity, they would be prosecuted if there could be any link that was drawn between them and someone that the U.S. government has put on an FTO list. I mean, back at the time of the Humanitarian Law Project case, I mean, Jimmy Carter was very concerned that his organization's work, which was not a cash-making enterprise, but it was a peacemaking organization, that they could be prosecuted simply because they were interacting with groups that had been targeted or had engaged in armed struggle, even while their actions were purely for peaceful ends, the Carter Center's action. So now all of that goes out the window when it comes to Clinton Inc. and Podesta and all of those who are just happily taking cash from the Saudi government, which is acknowledged to be a funder for ISIL.
Mike Prisoner, the same Huffington Post piece, wrote, WikiLeaks revealed a 2009 cable by then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton saying, quote, this is Hillary Clinton's words, more needs to be done since Saudi Arabia remains a critical financial support base for Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, Lashkar, Al-Tayyiba, and other terrorist groups, close quote. Instead of sanctioning the Saudis, Clinton did the opposite. She authorized enormous quantities of weapons to be sold to them. On Christmas Eve in 2011, Hillary Clinton and her closest aide celebrated a massive $29.4 billion sale to the Saudis of over 80 F-15 fighter jets manufactured by Boeing, a company which coincidentally contributed $900,000 to the Clinton Foundation. In a chain of enthusiastic emails, an aide exclaimed that it was, quote, not a bad Christmas present. Of course, you have the people in Yemen being bombed by Saudi Arabia. You have Saudi Arabia funding Al-Qaeda and ISIS in Syria, the United and in Iraq. The United States says the U.S. government must go back and have long war, endless war in Syria and Iraq. to stop ISIS and or to degrade and defeat them because they constitute an existential threat. But here are their main financiers, and they're getting all of the money. They're getting huge contracts, and they're calling it a big Christmas present.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, that's a completely sick description when you're seeing what those Christmas presents are actually doing around the world, not just in Yemen, but beyond. I mean, it really just is emblematic of how this political clique works. Clinton and the Podestas are really just this match made in ruling class heaven. I think there's no, you know, if you look at all the corruption of the Clinton Foundation and pay to play, there's no real rival and no one at that level of corruption than the Podesta brothers themselves, with the Podesta Group and with the Center for American Progress, which was, you know, run by John Podesta, now by Neera Tanden, who's also a big topic of these emails. You know, these people are being projected as kind of like sympathetic figures, you know, just poor Clinton staffers who got their emails hacked and now their personal lives are out there. But John Podesta is considered one of, if not the most powerful lobbyist in the entire world. In the year 2009, White House documents showed that the Podesta brothers visited the White House 25 times in that year alone. By contrast, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited the White House one time. John Podesta, before he became Obama's senior advisor, had visited the White House 130 times on these types of visits, close friend of Obama. But, you know, these were advocating on behalf of those who are paying him. You know, Boeing, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, all of these are donors to the Podesta brothers in one form of another, whether it's through the Center for American Progress or the Podesta Group. And so this plays out in all these different ways, like the way you mentioned with this huge arms deal, but also in other ways, too. I mean, one of the big things that I found going through, you know, all of the actions of Podesta's Center for American Progress is that during Obama's stimulus package, you know, there was a huge amount of money, billions of dollars set aside for so-called clean energy initiatives in his stimulus project. So the major recipients of that stimulus money in clean energy, in fact, 17 of the top recipients of big so-called clean energy corporations were donors to the Center for American Progress, who is at the White House lobbying on behalf of all of these companies to get the stimulus money. Not only that, but people had direct connections. For example, Jose Villarreal, you know, who's now the treasurer of the Clinton campaign, was on the board of directors of First Solar, one of the companies that got a lot of money, and the Center for American Progress. But the biggest recipient, this company called First Solar, was actually a project of this business alliance of the Center for American Progress itself. So they were lobbying for themselves to get the stimulus money, of which they got about $4 billion.
Amazing. Amazing corruption. A huge story, but turned into a second tier story by America's mainstream, that is the corporate-owned mainstream media. We've been talking about the WikiLeaks revelations for the full hour. We've been joined by Mara Verheiden-Hilliard of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, Eugene Puryear, host of Radio Sputnik's By Any Means Necessary, and Michael Preisner. He is a producer for the Empire Files on Telesur. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear, with Brian Becker for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.